Hi, K-Chung listeners. This is Performance Now with John Tain and Carol Che. The focus of today's pre-recorded program is the longtime LA-based performance artist Jamie McMurray, who is unfortunately leaving us soon to move to Chile with his family. Jamie takes me and John on two very special field trips that help to illuminate aspects of his life and practice. In the first, we pay a visit to the Hall of Crucifixion and Forest Lawn Memorial Cemetery, where we are treated to the spectacular unveiling of a 200-foot biblical painting. In the second, John and Jamie have a picnic lunch in front of the home of a mass murderer. Keep listening to find out why these two sites mean so much to Jamie.
So now we're walking into the hall.
So guys, take a seat anywhere you like, okay?
Okay. Carol's saying, holy crap holes. Okay, where do you want to sit?
Somewhere in the middle, I guess.
Okay. Okay, you choose. Okay, so just to fill everyone in, we're in the Hall of the Crucifixion here at Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale. Carol and I are about to witness...
who knows what?
A spectacle for all mankind. About to start. I can feel it.
Oh my god. This is very Kenneth Anger so far.
Crucifixion Resurrection. What you are about to witness is the realization of the dream of three visionaries. Ignaz Paderewski, who inspired it. Jan Stika, who created it. And Dr. Hubert Eaton, who discovered it and built its permanent home. The painting's storied history begins in 1894, when Poland's esteemed pianist and statesman, Ignaz Paderewski, attended the opening of the Battle of Roslavica. This massive panorama depicted a key battle.
Behold, the light. Well, so what did you think, Carol?
Are you recording?
Yeah.
Wow.
195 feet of wonder.
Panoramic.
Yes, bye-bye.
Hey. How's it going?
All right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
pretty
was
weird, huh?
Stunning.
Yeah.
I didn't know they did that in there.
Well, that's the thing that's so interesting about it, is there's this hidden away thing that nobody seems to know anything about. There's a place we can sit over there if you guys want to.
Okay.
Do you have to... Do you need anything?
Okay.
Yeah. Restroom's right there if you guys need the restroom.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it to me. I try to turn a lot of people onto it, and I've tried, you know, with this same kind of... Okay. have tried for years to turn friends and people on to all of the odd things that I have found in Los Angeles that I think are unique, that have ended up being, you know, the things that define what the city is for me, more than the big, vast, general things that everybody kind of knows about, that we've experienced, that we're sort of immersed in every day.
Well, this is a big, vast thing, too.
It is, but it's a big, vast thing that nobody knows about. You know, this, as opposed to our relationship with Los Angeles being defined by traffic, or being defined by weather, or being defined by the beach, for me, it's defined by these weird things.
So how did you stumble across this strange thing?
Do you want to sit?
Sure.
Okay. My nephew was visiting from Chile, and he's a Lego fanatic. I mean, he was, like, he was 10 at the time, now he's 13, so he's like a Red Hot Chili Peppers fanatic or whatever the next
Now that he's all grown up, he's moved beyond Legos.
Right. And this weird little museum that they have here had an exhibition of this artist who creates sculptures out of Legos. He wanted to come and see it. So my wife, his aunt, brought us up here, and we were like, what is that thing? And just happened to be here, you know, at a time that it was showing, because it shows every hour on the hour, and it's all kind of vague, and they don't really tell you, you know, what you're here for. You just are supposed to know, and if you don't know, then you see signs that say, like, wait here at 11, and there's no other information about it. And
I assume it's in the brochures somewhere, or the guidebooks, or something.
You'd think that it would be, and it probably is in some places, you know? But you have to look for it. You know, you can't just go online and find out about it like most museums or most spaces that have this public spectacle that they want to show off to people, right? Like, they have this big, important, crazy thing that they built a fucking cathedral for, right? So it's not put out there. As like, come and check out this amazing thing.
They keep behind curtains.
And then you don't know, right? Then the second one is revealed, and you have no idea what's coming, right? And they've built this massive mechanism to be able to house this thing, but they don't really, like, tell people, come see this amazing thing at Forest Lawn, right? It's the same with the silent movie theater in Hollywood. It's the same with another silent movie theater that's down in Marina Del Rey that we discovered about a year ago that's really amazing. That this older gay couple bought like 40 years ago and refurbished it, and now they're in their 70s, and they still roll out in their little like rascal scooters for every show to play the organ along with the... Do you know this place?
The silent... Yeah, I know the silent
in Marina
movie
Del Rey.
Theater. Not the one in Marina Del Rey.
It's pretty drippy.
Yeah. But, no, I totally agree with you, though, that that's a very L.A. thing. Like, I've never found this to be true anywhere else, where like, amazing things like this exist, and they're not necessarily, like, well-promoted or you know, it's not, like, this really obvious thing. It's like you really do have to, like, just sort of hunt for or stumble across these things.
Yeah. Diamonds in the rough.
Yes, many of them.
Yeah, and it's got like, it's for me, it's definitive of a West Coast kind of attitude. I'm going to make this thing and people are just going to come and I don't need to promote it. It's a roadside attraction kind of mentality.
Although even San Francisco, I think all of its splendors are pretty well known and obvious.
Yeah, that's very true.
Maybe because it's smaller.
Well, there is a special thing about Los Angeles where we sort of thrive on the reputation that we have. It has, up until recently, and of course it's ebbed and flowed, kept people away at the same time that it's attracted interesting people. And so that's kind of defined its personality in a lot of ways, too, I think. Portland felt like that for a long time for me. Seattle felt like that for a long time for me, both places where I spent many years as well. And Seattle now is very different, but when I first moved there in the late 80s, early 90s, it had that kind of quirky, weird stuff, too. you know, that you just had to know about. It wasn't in, like, any kind of guidebook or, you know, you couldn't go on Yelp to read the review about the weird underground tunnels, you know, beneath Pioneer Square and things like that. But, I don't know. It's just, it's one person's perspective, and having found all these things and feeling like they're my little gems, right? They're like my little pieces of Los Angeles that define the character of the town for me. And then turning them on to key people. So then my view of my town then influences what other people's view of this place is as well. It's sort of, you know, parallel to art making, right? Like you're always wanting to influence people's perception so that's a little closer to what your view is. You want them to look at your work and spend time with your work so that it's a little closer to how you see those things.
Yeah, I really like the passing from person to person as opposed to mass numbers of people reading about it in the LA Weekly or whatever. Yeah. Like, when I was in there, I already thought of, like, one or two people that I totally want to take care and surprise with this.
A lot of people.
I incorporated this into a project that was one of the things that I showed at Human Resources, and it's kind of vague about how it became represented. Because I've developed these ideas of works that I wanted to generate that are performative, but they're more, you know, founded in the world of conceptual art and the history of conceptual art than they are in performance. And so I would find these places and these spaces and build these relationships with them, and then concepts that I wanted to incorporate into art making would work their way into the place. As opposed to finding a place and going, oh my God, I have to think of something that I can make here.
Yeah.
I would take these concepts for actions that I wanted to accomplish, and then I would find the space and marry them together.
Yeah, so you're sort of culling, like, influences and possible ingredients to sort of cook in your work later on.
You have them all laid out, and then when they're all kind of in front of you and more clear, then you can see, like, what am I going to mix with which one, like, which combinations of these things are going to work, right? So that they're evoking what I want to evoke with the action and the idea behind the action, but then they also have this relationship to this place and this town and my own personal experiences with this space that we occupy. And what I did here was I had a puzzle made of the first painting, the Jan Stika painting.
Like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, a 1,000-piece puzzle.
God.
And I sat in a motorhome out parked in front of the space.
It's so
here.
Big, though. So a 1,000 pieces doesn't go that far.
No. Yeah. It was like only like a snippet of the painting. You know, it wasn't the whole thing. Yeah. And it was a nightmare. You know, it was the hardest, worst performance I ever did. And three people came and saw it. You know.
You were in the trailer and you put
So I was set up in a motorhome in front of the Hall of the Crucifixion here.
Really? And they let you just set up the
Well, they didn't let me do anything. You know, this place is one of those weird kind of public, kind of private spaces. I mean, it's totally a private space, right?
Yeah.
But because people come and they mourn and they're here for that purpose and they're here to spend time here, also like it's a park of sorts. That a lot of it goes unmonitored and unwatched, as it should be.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that's how it's made. It's made for that. So I came up here every day for like 14 days. Not every consecutive day, but you know, several days over an extended period. And set up the puzzle in a motorhome and would just spend hours putting it together. And I filmed the whole thing in real time.
This was the one last year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then I was inviting people on Facebook saying, you can come and you can see me do this thing. And I would just post like a picture of the motorhome, right? Or I would just post a picture of the cathedral facade, you know. And so I would say you come at this specific time, right? So people poke their head into the motorhome. I was also cooking bacon because I just wanted to
in
add this kind of like aural weird thing to it. You know, this other layer of a sensation, you know. And that's the smell that I'm most used to smelling in a motorhome, is bacon.
Bacon and Christ.
Bacon and Christ. Yeah, not for our Jewish friends. But
Jesus Christ, bacon star.
the hall of the, well, I won't go on that. So people would come in and they would sit and they would kind of watch me put the puzzle together for a while, which was maddening, you know. It would take an hour to do a piece. It was really elaborate and ridiculous. And they would have some bacon, and then I would say at a certain time, like 5 minutes before the hour, knowing that the thing is going to show, mm-hmm. go into the church now to mm-hmm. whoever was there. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it was only a few people that came over the course of this time. Mm-hmm. And they would go in, and then they would see, right? So they would see, they would smell the bacon, they would see this setting of me being out in the motorhome, they would see the puzzle being put together. There's a photograph of the finished version of what the puzzle is supposed to look like that I'm constantly referencing. So they get a sense of what the image is that I'm putting together. Mm-hmm. And then they go in unexpectedly and see this, you know, massive mural that is the puzzle, and then they come back out and they see the puzzle continuing to be put together some more after the presentation, and then they leave. And so then what I showed at Human Resources was some of the footage of the puzzle being put together, and then the puzzle, the finished puzzle.
The finished puzzle, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember that was on the wall of the near the corner. Right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And there were some other works that were part of that series that had some similar conceptual relationship. I did one piece that was called landscape painting, where I painted a landscape, and then I modified the landscape, influenced for sure by things like what Francis Alise does or has done.
Right.
Chopped down the trees and modified the landscape, and then repainted the modified landscape and showed those, you know, as this funny little triptych kind of mocking landscape painting. And then the other part of that series was I had a little electric piano, and I went and I set up in a house that was in Laurel Canyon, very close to where Jim Morrison used to live, close to where Houdini lived, and close to where Mama Cass lived, and, you know, this crazy history in this Laurel Canyon place, and tried to teach myself how to play a Doors song, which didn't go well.
Didn't go well, really?
No, not really. You think if you have any sense of tone or notes or music at all that you can hear, and then you can just match it, you know, on a piano. You just match the note, and you just kind of make yourself your own kind of version of sheet music if you don't know how to read sheet music, and you just...
So, meaning you have no musical training?
Well, I do have some musical training, but it was so long ago, I don't remember any of it. It's all gone, you know.
Which song were you trying to learn?
L.A. Woman.
Classic. Yeah.
Is that what it was? An hour ago. Dun, 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 dun. Take a look around, say which way the wind blows. Yeah, L.A.
That's
Woman.
A great song. tell us about your history with L.A. Like, how long have you lived here, and what made you move here, all that stuff?
Well, I moved here in 96. I came here from Seattle. My youth was spent in a tiny little farming community in Washington State. A super real redneck, super white, super racist farming community. And, you know, there were significant minority populations there. There was a significant Native American population there. And I say was because it's really gone now. And there is a significant Latin community there because there's tons of farming. Yakima Valley, which is where I'm from, Yakima, they produce 78% of all of the hops that are grown in the United States. And that's not even their main, you know, produce. Really, their main produce is apples, cherries, and fruits and things like that. So anyways, there's this massive Latin population there. And it was that really stereotypical situation that seemed like a holdover from the 40s and the 50s, where it was all of the minorities doing all of the work to run the town, and the and the middle class and upper class being all white. And it's held on that way. Just in the last 5 years, the Latin population has surpassed the white population in that town. So now there's some pretty dramatic shifts in what's going on sociologically there. But anyways, I grew up there and got the fuck out of there as soon as possible because it's pretty a treacherous place, a pretty horrible place in a lot of ways. And went to Seattle and was in Seattle during this great time of music and art, and then left when that all started to get really destroyed. And that's why I came to L.A.
Are you talking about the whole grunge period?
But just prior to that becoming super popular, it was more about just the people that were playing music. I mean, it was a collective of all different kinds of freaks, like rushing together to make wild things, and And I found a lot of interesting experimental theater practitioners in that era. And it was just a really great and seminal time for me.
Were you in college at that time?
I was, yeah.
At UW?
No, I was at a community college in Seattle. And then, you know, I'd drop out for a while because it was way more fun to not be in college than it was to be in college at that time. Uh-huh. And then I was, you know, take some classes at the University of Washington and try to get in on that a little bit. And that scene, which was the theater scene at that time, was centered around the theater department at UW. Uh-huh. And so a lot of the experimental performance groups were coming out of that department. Mm-hmm. So hover around that scene for a while.
Did you perform in plays or anything like that?
I did, yeah. I did some traditional theater, especially when I first started school, which was at a different community college in my hometown.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I did some traditional theater. And
as an actor or as a director?
Yeah, as an actor, actor.
Uh-huh.
You know, the greatest benefit of all those experiences was that I got to see more clearly what I wanted to do with performance. I saw it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But another great benefit was participating in a communal kind of thing, right? Because you're painting the sets and you're sweeping the stage and then you're acting, right? And then you're all going out and partying together and spending all your private time or your spare time together as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a great benefit of that experience. But coming from Los Angeles to Seattle had to do with feeling like everybody was leaving and Seattle was changing and we were all being pushed out because it was becoming a wealthy person's town and running away from a heartbreak and, you know, a lot of different things. And came here and came here at a time that nobody was coming here, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
But
it was a moment when there was a lot of performance that was happening.
There was, yeah. And I immediately got connected to a lot of the people in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thrilling because then all of a sudden there was a community of people who were more like-minded, not just generally like-minded, where all the freaks get together just because they all have purple hair.
Uh-huh.
And then they sort of flush out that they don't like each other very much later down the road, right? This was more really connecting with a group that was super like-minded. But at the same time, I was showing most of my work in other countries and other places, so sort of in this community here in L.A. and out of it a lot of the time, too.
So where were you going? Sorry.
Who in L.A. were you connecting with at that time?
Well, Nicole Hebron, you know, was one of the first people I met when I came down here. I met her when I came down to do a performance at the Old Zoo that was organized by a group called Foundation for Artist Resources. And so they organized a performance event that happened in the old cages at the zoo, at the abandoned zoo that's in Griffith Park.
Uh-huh.
And they invited me.
Just another one of those crazy sites.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I've gone back and done actions there, too. I've gone back and done stuff there just recently in the last year or so. And so I met Nicole there. I met an artist named Jessica Beagie who went to Claremont and spent a lot of her time here in California, but has since, and then lived in New York for many years in the early 2000s, and then has since relocated back to her hometown in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron Athey I met at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's a massive a group of artists that are kind of around Ron, whom I met through him over time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like I said, the performance opportunities that I was finding were mostly in Canada and Western Europe. So that's where I was showing a lot of my work, but then was connected to this performance community here and was sort of one foot in one world and one foot in another world. They seemed really separate at that time, but that was okay for me. I didn't need those worlds to combine.
Well, that's another thing that's very possible, I guess, in LA. I mean, it's, a lot of people do that.
Yeah, totally, right? Yeah. Like, that was the lifestyle.
Yeah.
You and I still see it in most people that I know, like, right, you're a sex worker sometimes to make money, and then sometimes you have a really weird, legitimate job, like archiving medical files, and then, you know, and then you teach for a while, and then, you know, you make maybe a little bit of money off of a grant, or you do a piece of work that sells, or something like that, and you just hodgepodge it all together, and so that's how it was for me for a really long time. Still is, actually.
Okay. Have you
Minus the sex working part, although I would admit to that if that were true. I wouldn't be ashamed, but I wouldn't tell you.
Have you lived in L.A. consistently since
96? No. I got a teaching job in Boston, so I was teaching at the museum school out there, which was one of the few places in the country that had an actual performance art department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we know a lot of the people that came out of there, like Paul Waddell and...
Yeah. Parker Davis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's still a pretty awesome active performance scene there, but that performance department at that school has deteriorated pretty significantly in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, just sort of a bummer.
Is it the same story that's been happening all over?
Yeah.
All over the...
Totally.
Just killing the department.
Killing the department, people being very committed to the department over many, many years, and then being told in May that their contract for September is not going to be renewed.
Wow.
Right. And then other
that
teachers...
Familiar.
Yeah,
that
right? Like
really
it happens
familiar.
Everywhere. Yeah.
The fuck?
And so, and then other teachers sort of feeling that intense solidarity and going, I'm not going to stick around for this. This is bullshit. And then they leave, right? And then entire departments are wiped out.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the administration doesn't care because it's, quite frankly, it's too hard to recruit with that being part of your curriculum. You know what I mean? Like, you can't, the administration of all, of every institution that I've ever worked for, which includes Art Center here in Pasadena, is way more focused on what you as a teacher or as an individual or as a known artist who's going to come and do a class here or a class there can do for the recruiting of the of students to the school. That's the thing, right? So if you have a really popular class that's overrun with people and they can spin that and get students to come to that, then you have some value that's worth retaining. But everybody at Art Center, and I haven't been out there for a while, so I don't really know what it's like today. I assume that it's the same. Everybody in the fine art department at Art Center is part-time, so that they don't have to provide benefits. There are a couple of instructors who technically are full-time because they teach foundation classes in other areas outside of fine art, right? So I think that it's fair to say that they're in the fine art department. Any teachers that are exclusively teaching in the fine art department are part-time, get no benefits, and basically just get, you know, an hourly rate to teach those courses. You could certainly make the case that it's a method to allow those institutions to survive. From my perspective, I can see that objectively. Subjectively, I don't agree with that position at all.
Yeah.
I don't think that. I think if you can't, I think if you need to make all your teachers part-time and deny them basic, you know, rights that employees should receive for working so hard for a big institution, you have to cut their benefits and force them to modify their lives to accommodate what you need, then you're just not cutting in the right place. Like, you're not looking in the right place. You're mismanaging.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, as people say, administrator salaries have gone up while, you know, teacher salaries have been cut. Anyway, but that's something we can talk about for hours. Obviously, it's an epidemic.
Yeah,
but,
that's a hard topic to avoid and not get too deep in. Yeah,
I know. So you were in Boston for a while.
Right, so I was in Boston for a couple of years. I would have liked to have stayed. I was asked to stay, to stick around and try to help build the department up even more with the people that were there. And it was a really fantastic opportunity, but I didn't like the city and I had to come back to LA. I had to come back here.
So how long were you out there for?
3 years. No, two years. Mm-hmm. 2 years. Yeah, because it started with replacing a teacher that was on sabbatical, Marilyn Arsum. And then when she came back that second year, it was like, well, a whole bunch of kids are signing up for classes, so we need to expand the faculty. So why don't you just stick around for another year while we do a faculty search? And then when the search started to create a permanent position out of that new position, I was ready to go.
Yeah, and you say you had to come back to L.A. Was it because you were really into the L.A. scene, or?
Well, it was that, you know, it was this overwhelming feeling of it being home and always thinking about getting home, you know, getting home to individuals that are friends that don't have anything to do with the art community, getting home to this the place and the weather and the things of this town that I feel like connected to that I need to see all the time.
Yeah.
Like this weird place.
Yeah.
You know, I need to see this weird shit all the time.
Well, and yet you're leaving us very soon.
For a while. Not forever.
For a summer.
Not forever.
Yeah. For
well,
like
for
a,
some
for
years.
Like a year.
Yeah. What? For a year?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, going to Chile for probably what's going to turn out to be a couple of years, but you never know what's going to happen. You go chasing something, and some small shift in your view can all of a sudden change everything.
Right, right.
Mm. Permanently.
Yeah.
You know, so we could easily get down there and go, oh, let's open a bar. Like, that sounds cool. And then we just do that, and then we never leave because we discover how awesome it is to own a bar.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of awesome, doesn't
it? It does sound really awesome. Yeah.
And you get in a place like South America, it just seems like, and I've been to Santiago a lot. I know the town pretty well.
So that's where you're going to be going.
Yeah,
Santiago.
Yeah. It seems like it's a new world for someone who spent their whole life in the United States and a good portion of their life in California and Los Angeles. It seems like there are so many things that aren't there that are here. Mm-hmm. There is a real palpable hunger for contemporary art. There's a lot more weird, like, infighting and bickering and bitterness amongst a community, but it's still a tighter community. Everybody goes to everything all the time without fail. That's pretty exciting.
Okay. So you must be already pretty connected to that community.
Well, only through my wife,
who's
native Chilean.
She's from Santiago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So through her, I've met a lot of interesting people. Through the international performance community, I only know a couple of people in the art scene in Santiago.
Hmm.
But Alejandra's participated in this show called The Chilean Miracle, which refers to the economic boom that's taking place in Chile right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that involved several artists that came up here from Santiago.
Mm-hmm.
In this big group show. So then I got to know them as a result of this show happening at Human Resources over the last couple of weeks. And they're really interesting crew. Honestly, you know, I find that people in Santiago are friendlier than I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more gregarious than I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little off-putting.
Uh-huh.
And they're always like, why is the gringo so dour all the time? Like, is he mad at all of us or something? Because he doesn't want to talk to us constantly, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I thought, okay, well, this is a significant thing that I'm going to have to adjust to in Chile.
Right.
You know, I'm going to have to kind of put on a show sometimes for people reluctantly being more conversive and outgoing and stuff. I'm going to have to do that to engage because that's what everybody's like. And I'm going to totally be ostracized if I'm not.
You're going to have to be extroverted.
That's what I thought, right? And then this group of Chilean artists came, and I spent time with them, and they're all wearing black all the time and listening to really weird music all the time and super dour, and they don't want to talk every second of every day. And I went, oh, my God, thank God. Here they are.
I guess I would be like, you know, if someone came from somewhere else and, like, only met a bunch of Huntington Beach housewives at first, and they're like, oh shit, I have to,
you know what, and
get
it's
my nails done.
It's the immigrant experience.
Yeah.
It's totally the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. It's why we all kind of group together in communities of people where we all look alike, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it takes time for you to sort of go, oh my, I don't want to be in this community at all, or I don't want to hang out with these particular individuals at all, but it takes, you know, years.
It's the whole acclimating to a new place and finding your way. Finding your people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's happening soon, very soon.
Okay. Well, we're at our half-hour mark, and we have another trip to do tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Do we still want to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us or now, or do you want it to be like a surprise tomorrow?
Why don't we just meet there? I'll send you the information later this afternoon.
Okay.
I'll bring some lunch.
Okay. At noon?
Yeah. email me some dietary restrictions if you guys have any dietary restrictions. I'll bring a little lunch. We'll have a little picnic.
Awesome. Sounds great. Okay. So okay. To be continued then.
Tomorrow.
At noon.
So here we are sitting at the corner of Yorkshire and Kansas.
Yorkshire and Kansas Avenue in Santa Monica.
And Jamie, can you tell us a little about this kind of funky looking house that we're looking at? Oh, well, and we've got a table and we're having Zanku chicken lunch.
And in keeping with this ongoing project where I'm collecting objects that have some kind of significance because they were witness to trauma, or some kind of significance because they were witness to what other people might perceive as being historical moments or places or people.
Uh-huh.
This is a table that I got at an auction at Bob Hope's house.
Oh, crazy.
So this is Bob Hope's table that we're having lunch at here.
Although presumably it was not a witness to any kind of trauma.
Well, I mean, being
Bob
around Bob Hope,
Bob
I
had
don't
a long
know,
life. Right.
I would consider that traumatic, but my parents probably would consider that to be something better.
Yeah, my grandmother, I think, loved Bob Hope.
So. Yeah, he's this iconic kind of figure, and we end up with this table in our house. But But it's very much in keeping with this idea of collections as conceptual art projects, archiving as practice. And the thing that makes that most interesting to me is that you get a picture into the mind of the artist and what their idea of value in objects are. And I think when you can understand the value of an object or an art material to a particular artist, then you understand better what their work is supposed to be about, and you understand better what their practice is. So I have that concept kind of deeply embedded in my work and my performance practice. I have that relationship with objects, and these other kind of conceptual projects, I have that more overt relationship with objects.
Yeah.
But that's why the table's here with us today. This house is a burned-out house, and what happened here a few years ago was that a young man named John Zawari murdered his father and his brother inside this house, set the house on fire.
So the three of them lived here.
That's right. And from what I understand,
right by where, like, we've got the 10 freeway right behind
us. The 10 freeway is literally 100 yards from us, if not less, and so you can kind of hear
that. It's a beautiful
that.
Day, except there's this totally burned-out house,
Yeah, it's a weird scene for a place like Santa Monica, and you know what makes it even odder is that it's sat here for so many years, just burned out like this, waiting for whatever to happen with it is going to happen with it.
Yeah,
but from what I understand correctly, John, who everybody perceives as being the perpetrator in this situation, lived here periodically with his father and his brother. His mother lived in another part of the city, and and he would live with her periodically as well. He spent his time there. He spent his time here. So one day, he committed these murders, set the house on fire, carjacked a vehicle, forced the driver to drive him to Santa Monica College, which is about 2 miles away from here, not very far. On the way there, he shot other people.
Yeah,
and committed other murders, and then did the same at the school. Once he arrived there, he got out of the car and was on foot. The woman who he carjacked, incidentally, survived this whole ordeal. And then the police shot and killed him in the library of the school. This is more one of the more well-known.
I remember that
crime
happening.
Scenes. That I visited. And this was maybe the second or third one that I came to see. But
ever. You mean like...
As part of this project, Which, you know, ultimately ended about a year ago. I stopped with this project. The whole work is pretty dense, and I won't go into all the details of it. But the part that I refer to as the object witness part of the project was... originated from the idea that I would understand better what my relationship with objects was, and the same thing that we were just talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
understanding the artist's relationship with the materials that they're working with. Mm-hmm. Beyond understanding the relationship, the painter's relationship with color and things like that. More complicated relationships, I think. Mm-hmm. Historical relationships that you have with objects or with people or with places. And
yeah.
So anyways, oh, thank you. I decided that I would go and engage in a series of exercises and connect them to a conceptual art project in which I would try to convince my own skeptical mind of the ability for inanimate objects to retain power and energy in a metaphysical way.
Yeah.
Metaphysics and spirituality are things that are not a big part of my life. They're not things that I believe or buy into. But I wanted to see how deep I could go with this idea that inanimate objects retain trauma that they're a witness to. Mm-hmm. So the obvious place for me to go would be to scenes where there were intense trauma that had been experienced.
Yeah.
So I would find out about these crime scenes, suicide scenes, accident scenes. Uh-huh. And I would go and collect objects that were clearly near where the death had taken place.
Yeah.
And this was one of them. Mm-hmm. And then as you saw at Human Resources last month, I exhibited all those objects.
Yeah. And then so for this one, you know, how did you go about picking?
Well, it's funny. The logistics of it are kind of complicated, and they're probably identical. We're eating lunch, by the way, too. Yeah. So we're sort of stuffing our mouths with Zanku chicken.
Yeah.
While we're trying to talk, but it's not dissimilar to the process involved in how press chooses to cover stories, or how a forensics team chooses to come in and deal with a particular site. This was a really traumatic scene, but because it was so clear who the perpetrator was, and there was such an overwhelming amount of evidence, videotapes and documentation, all this stuff of the crime actually being committed, the police had a really dirty scene here.
Yeah.
Where dirty as in it was contaminated by lots of investigators, lots of onlookers, lots of press, like...
Yeah.
It was really easy to just walk into the scene because the police were making no effort to close it off.
Yeah. Oh, really? They weren't. They weren't keeping people away.
I came here 2 days after it happened and walked into this burned out house.
Wow, crazy.
I collected mail that belonged to the victims and the murderer. Uh-huh. I collected clothing and other objects that were in the house. Mm-hmm. So that was sort, you know, that was always the protocol in deciding how to deal with it. You know, would I find materials? Mm-hmm. Would everything be totally cleaned and collected?
Yeah.
Would I be able to get into the property? Would I be able to get close? Was I getting there too soon and the police would still be there? Was I getting there too late and it was overrun by mourners? Because that was another weird logistical thing that I had to contend with is I wouldn't go to these places if there were people there mourning and laying out candles and flowers because they didn't want to interfere with that.
Yeah. It's like a different
private
process.
Experience. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay.
And then you get inside, and I have gloves and tools and baggies and everything, just like a forensics investigator. And that's how I would collect these materials.
Like CSI.
Documenting where I found them, taking measurements. Terrified. Always terrified. Mm-hmm. Always feeling the physical trauma of the place and the space and the object.
Yeah.
You smell this burned smell from this house, even though we're sitting, you know, 30 feet away from it.
Yeah.
All of the materials that I collected from these different varied scenes had that death smell to them. So they became these visceral, performative processes of collecting these objects and these materials. And eventually I became so traumatized and really started to feel these, you know, spiritual things, these supernatural things that I don't understand.
Yeah.
That I decided it was time to stop. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, you may not understand this shit that you're fucking with right now, but it's going to have an effect on you. It's going to have an effect on your personality and your spirit and your behavior. And it did, and she was right. And so it stopped. I stopped collecting these things and stopped this project.
Yeah.
But luckily, you know, at the time that it stopped, I felt like I'd collected enough material to show it effectively. So
when it showed at Human Resources, it showed like a natural history museum display.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the concept behind it, is I wanted to have that traditional, almost formal...
Like distanced.
Distance and display of objects. So mm-hmm. you're having the same experience you're having when you go to a natural history museum and you see some ceramic from the Ming Dynasty.
Uh-huh.
You're kind of distanced from it, right? Then you start reading the text, mm-hmm. and you do the guide by cell feature, which was this thing where I had... Mm-hmm. What I would do is I would voice record myself when I was at the location collecting the objects.
Yeah.
So I would say, oh, now I'm in the house of such and such location where so-and-so and so-and-so were murdered, mm-hmm. and I'm collecting a shoe mm-hmm. or whatever. So when people are looking at the objects in the exhibition, they're able to use their phones to dial into a particular code mm-hmm. and hear that original recording of my experience collecting the material.
Yeah.
So that draws them into the story more mm-hmm. than just that distant mm-hmm. experience that you have with objects in a more traditional museum context.
Yeah. But it's almost like you are... the performance, if we can call it that, is partly, on the one hand, you're kind of enacting this kind of forensic exercise, right,
yeah.
of going to these sites and examining all of the material that you find, but then it's also, like, that's almost like the first part of it, and then there's this other part of it where you're kind of miming the museum in some ways, like mm-hmm. you're creating these displays, and then you're even creating the guide by selfie tour kind mm. of thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's you doing it, but it's like you're making a museum of the morbid or something.
The museum of death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that an obsession with death and mortality and this sort of crime fixation...
Like the limits, yeah.
...that I have mm-hmm. has an influence on what this project turned out to be.
Yeah.
Conceptually, you know, in engaging in formal discourse with people about it, mm-hmm. I try to hold true to this concept mm-hmm. of it being an experiment in understanding what my relationship with objects were, what mm-hmm. is, and an attempt to change my view about mm-hmm. the ability of an inanimate object to retain trauma and energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are all these other layers that mm-hmm. I knew about prior to the project beginning mm-hmm. and discovered, you know, throughout the course of the project being executed.
Yeah.
And that's definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. what you're describing is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting also the way that it taps into, you know, like performance art itself, right, in its relationship to the way that performance art is experienced. Because I think if you look... You know, speaking of someone who just, you know, recently passed away, Chris Burden, mm. you know, I mean, he was part of this generation that really thought of performance as being kind of something that had to be experienced, you know, while you were there. Mm. And not everything else was just kind of, you know, the after or whatever. But I think very quickly you come out to the fact that all of it was, the performance itself has a very ephemeral existence.
Mm.
And, you know, it didn't take long, you know, before he got around to kind of making those books of documentation of the performances. And then afterwards, the way that all of the things that were associated became relics, right? Like, and that was his term. Like,
right.
he called, you know, like, when he, like, had those studs pressed into his chest, like, those are, like, the relics of that performance, you know?
Right,
like,
or the nails
yeah,
from the VW crucifixion yeah. that Jasper Johns owns in his
yeah.
own private collection. Yeah, those became these important objects, right?
Yeah.
Well, I absolutely align my live art practice mm-hmm. with that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be experienced.
Yeah.
You can show photographs and mm-hmm. you can show objects, and I tend to not show objects from that
yeah.
type of work that I generate.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to show documentation, but
yeah.
I try to show it in a way where it's clearly presented as documentation and not ever an attempt to be a replacement of the live experience. I totally feel that.
Mm-hmm.
This work is influenced by that attitude, but it's also influenced by other things, because
mm-hmm.
I'm never going to be an artist, and I don't ever want to be an artist that has a clear and didactic mantra
yeah.
that I pursue and
mm-hmm.
make the same work
yeah.
for 100 years and never convince myself that there's a possibility that that could change. I would rather that it's evolving and changing and shifting and and yeah, and so it feels performative.
Yeah.
Because that's my background, and I have a decent amount of experience doing performances in the street, guerrilla work.
Yeah.
And so when I would come to these sites and I would break into these, you know, crime scenes, I would feel that same sensation of a guerrilla action taking place.
Yeah.
And I would find that to run in parallel with what I was actually engaging in, because it was an art project that I was engaging in first and foremost.
Yeah.
So it felt performative while it was happening, but there are all these other ideas at play.
Yeah.
So I prefer to now identify it as being an art project or a practice with this particular work that transcends those kinds of traditional definitions. You know, it's conceptual art, but it's not. It's installation, but it's not. It's performative, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so I like that. I like those lines being really radically blurred. And the line that I like to blur the most is the one between existence and practice. And when you go out into these real scenarios where real people died and you're traumatized physically and spiritually by the energy that's around you when you're in this space, that's real.
Yeah.
But yet you're engaged in the execution of this art practice. So those are the most thrilling moments for me as an artist, are when that line is genuinely confused and you don't know where life starts and art begins and and all that stuff is genuinely for the artist. You know, it's easy to make that point for the viewer, right? To say, oh, I'm experimenting with this threshold between existence and practice, and it's easy for them to see in this really, like, clearly articulated and spoon-fed way. But when the person who's actually making the work can genuinely fool themselves, and existence and their existence and their practice genuinely starts to become confused, not mixed, but confused, I find that to be very successful.
Well, and I think one way that, you know, yesterday when we were at Forest Lawn, you know, and you were talking about you're finding these hidden locations. I mean, this is in some ways, you know, what you were talking about was your experience of Los Angeles itself, right? Your navigation of the city. And this seems to me like a different way also of navigating the city in a kind of almost like, you know, I mean, not necessarily that you were even explicitly referencing it, but there's, you know, like the noir aspect of LA, right? And there is a way in which you're kind of, this kind of draws that to mind, or makes, you know, makes kind of like, makes one think about that, you know? And so it's like a different way of mapping LA, you know, where you're kind of like producing an alternate trajectory or alternate kind of like itinerary of the city, you know, across like these crime scenes, right? And it's definitely like, I mean, you know, like, breaking, when you were talking about breaking down the kind of the work and the experience, lived experience, I mean, in some ways that is the way you're experiencing the city too, right?
Indeed. Like, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, and in the process of executing this project, I've been exposed to this whole other world in LA that I hadn't really been familiar with before. Murderabilia collectors.
Yeah.
The Museum of Death in Hollywood, you know, we made a joke about this, the work being a Museum of Death, but there's actually this super gruesome, really weird, kind of tough to see Museum of Death on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
And that's a massive world.
Well, and if you think of, like, Black Dahlia, like, you know, that whole, like, the myth of that.
The
right?
mythology that, behind that is prevalent in the, like, what do you call it, the discourse about LA every day. You know, it's still around, you know, and kind of honestly pales in comparison to what crime looks like today in Los Angeles, you know? It's a whole world of individuals, collectors, fanatics, whose perception of the character of this town is defined by the crime that has taken place here.
Yeah.
In the same way that 99% of the population of the world's perception of the character of this town exists because of the entertainment industry.
Okay. Yeah, so that's really interesting. Well, you know, one question I had for you was that, you know, yesterday we were also talking about your upcoming kind of, you know, you're going to be taking a break from this city anyway, and
right.
then you're going to Santiago. And I was just wondering, because, you know, I think, like, you know, it's very clear to me, like, how, you know, you've had this very productive relationship with LA in terms of both, like, the art scene, but also the city, and how that's kind of, you know, nurtured your work. And I was wondering, like, do you already see, like, how, you know, the move to Santiago, how that might be kind of, like, you know, having an effect, or how your work might, like, shift?
I hope so.
Uh-huh.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
I don't have a clear view of what that's going to look like.
Yeah. Because yesterday, for instance, you were talking about how people maybe are a little more, like, outgoing, extroverted, and you were a little
worried about that. Yeah. I don't know really what that's going to look like. I'm really proud of the work that I've done here in the time that I've been in Los Angeles, the last 25 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of the community that I'm part of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of love amongst all of those folks.
Yeah.
And I've produced the work of a lot of these people as well, and brought their work to the community, and they brought my work to the community. It's really been extraordinary. So coming off of that,
mm-hmm.
and desiring something new and radically different,
yeah.
is a big enough step for now.
Yeah.
What happens after that, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled by not knowing what that looks like, and simultaneously terrified by not knowing what that looks like.
Yeah.
My guess is that I'm immediately going to start doing a bunch of stuff in the street.
Uh-huh.
The big, tall, skinny gringo in a totally monochromatic society,
yeah.
doing street actions seems like the obvious place for me to start.
Uh-huh. That could be interesting. Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know what those are going to look like,
uh-huh.
but they're going to be about the sore thumb.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're going to be about, I stick out like a clown in this society. I'm going to take advantage of that and mm-hmm. see what it inspires.
Okay, cool. Well, that sounds like, yeah, I mean, kind of like starting with a blank slate.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Which is terrifying and liberating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's, yeah. Yeah, liberating, I think, is a good way to think about it. And,
yeah.
I mean, and like you said yesterday, you know, it's like it's an experiment. So you can see experimental living, right?
That's
an
right.
experiment in art
yeah.
making. So, well, cool. It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
and,
it's been fun.